welcome to an emergency edition of Conduct Detrimental, the Super League Symposium. This week, I'm joined by Stephanie Weisenberger and Taryn Sharma. What's up, guys?
What's up, gang?
What's up, gang?
So this, we haven't done an emergency episode since I think Rob Manfred made some really stupid comments once upon a time. Emergency episodes don't happen that often. This episode is such an emergency. I have not tweeted a single thing about Deshaun Watson today. So Deshaun Watson filed an answer in his civil case where he denied the charges, and he's very interesting defense of basically saying that his doctors recommended certain massage protocol, which we're going to have to dedicate an entire episode to, which I think is a fascinating, parentheses, stupid, close parentheses strategy. But Stephanie, I don't want to bury the lead here. What are your thoughts on this big Super League before we start with our first panel?
Well, hold on a little. I think we need to give some recognition to Aaron Donald, that story, because apparently it never actually happened, what he came out and alleged, especially because, you know, Aaron Donald came out and apologized. So earlier in the week, if you hadn't followed the story, DeVincent Spriggs alleged that Aaron Donald, Los Angeles Rams defensive lineman, had assaulted him at a Pittsburgh nightclub and gave him numerous stitches, broken arm, something along those lines, lots of injuries. His eye was all
Wonky.
Yes.
It looked like he was from Hitch, like he had an allergy.
That is a good comparison.
It's a good movie.
But apparently Donald didn't even attack the guy, and he actually came out and apologized like 2 days ago, saying sorry for filing this complaint of assault, making some public story about it, damaging your reputation. I don't know. Is there going to be a defamation suit coming soon on behalf of Aaron Donald against this DeVincent Spriggs? Maybe. Okay.
Stephanie, the answer is no, and you broke the rule, but I'm going to have to explain the rule of no talking about anything else, but I broke it, so I opened the door to that, okay? This is what we call opening the door to testimony, to bad testimony. There will not be a defamation case because, I mean, there could be, but Donald's not going to win. A defamation case brought by a public figure requires something called actual malice, basically that the person that said this quote-unquote false claim knew it to be false when they made it. So this guy, you read the allegations, at least by Aaron Donald's attorney, the guy was so drunk in this club and was walking around and took a swing at Aaron Donald. I mean, there's a world where the guy was just way too drunk to understand what happened. And then, you know, once he found out, he saw the surveillance video, he goes, my bad, Aaron, my bad. Don't attack me. Don't attack me physically or in court. So that's kind of what I thought that statement was about. But no more Aaron Donald, no more Deshaun Watson. This episode is appropriately titled the Super League Symposium. So, Taryn, as the resident soccer guru on this podcast, we have the sports betting guru, and Taryn, you are officially crowned and dubbed the soccer football guru. Tell us what's going on and why we needed an emergency podcast today.
Yeah, that's nice. I'll take it. So, the biggest competition in European soccer is currently the Champions League, but 12 of the top European football clubs, including England's Big Six and Barcelona, Real Madrid, have decided to come together to form the Super League. And the Super League is going to involve a competition amongst those 12 plus three more 15 permanent members and five other members that are on a rotating basis.
Taryn, before you go on, let me just read off these teams, okay? It's a who's who of international teams. It's AC Milan, it's Arsenal, it's Atletico Madrid, Chelsea, Barcelona, Inter Milan, Juventus, Liverpool, Man City, Man United, Real Madrid, and Tottenham. Ooh, there's some firepower there. There's some stuff.
Well, heavy hitters, Dan. They account for something like 80% of all of the Champions League wins. So, yeah, it's a very sizable number of clubs and big clubs in Europe. So this has the potential to really disrupt the way that European football is played, both on a domestic level and on the continental level.
Here's a little bit of what we're going to do today. And we wanted to keep this intro pretty tight because I know we have, I imagine, some football fans, some football nuts that want to get directly to the source. So what we've done, and anybody that follows us on social media, I sent out an SOS. I said, sports lawyers, assemble. And then what I did is I said, and one lucky law student can get Willy Wonka's golden ticket. But I kind of fudged a little bit because I let two law students on. So, guys, it's us three for the first panel. And then we're going to be joined by two law students. We'll let them introduce themselves on the podcast. Now, our second panel, this is when I called the Sports Lawyers Unite. It's going to be myself and let everybody introduce themselves. But two professors and two full-time practicing lawyers, recommended by many people, little crazy soccer slash football fans. But yeah, so the first panel, we're going to break, this is a Sports Law podcast, and I know a lot of people listening to this, and I have a lot of people in my DMs don't really know what's happening. They just see a lot of alert emojis and siren emojis, and they understand something big is happening. So the first part of this panel, we're going to kind of set the stage for just the sports element of it. We have a law student from Edinburgh who's going to talk about just on the ground what this means for just the being a fan of the game. So obviously, Sports Law podcast, and if I could have normal fans on, I would, but we have to have people that are training for JDs or whatever the JD equivalent is over in Scotland. I have no idea what it's called. This is we're all obviously fans first and lawyers second. That's usually how it works. Just don't tell our employers that. This is sports panel first. We're going to obviously get into a little bit of the legalese, a little bit of the labor issues, but we're going to try to save the larger, when the UEFA president says they're going to use all available remedies at their legal disposal, we're going to get into that on the second panel, which is going to be the law panel. The antitrust concerns, the union concerns, the CBA concerns, or the lack thereof. First part of the panel is going to be World Cup, Europa League, Champions League. We're going to get into the actually gameplay element. So this is probably safe to say it's going to be the longest episode that I've ever been a part of, because I usually try to keep us to a tight, 1 hour, give or take a couple minutes. Not today, folks. This is going to be a big jam-packed episode. Okay, before I turn it over to the first panel, Steph, what are your thoughts on this madness that is the Super League?
I mean, I don't really follow the European soccer football that much, but I do know that this is a pretty big deal, because I've seen the fans in these football stadiums are insane.
What's that word?
It's almost like,
what's that word?
Football.
Oh, okay. I thought you were saying that. Okay, keep going.
The fans for, I think, football, I'm going to say it again, Dan, keep laughing, whatever. I'm trying to get the accent on, but the fans are crazy. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see whether the fans of the Liverpool, Man City teams that are a part of the Super League are going to continue following them, or if they're almost going to boycott their teams because it kind of breaks with tradition and everything behind that. And so I think it's going to be pretty interesting to see in the future. But at the same time, I think this might be something that UEFA needs to pay attention to. You know, they already know that the players haven't been big fans of the way that it's structured. You know, it's a corrupt system. There's been rumblings of that in the past. Not everyone is a fan of the way that they are governing the league. And so I think this might also be a wake-up call for them to be like, look, these teams that are the reason your broadcast deals are this big have the power to just walk away. And if you let them, then so does all of your broadcast rights money. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen in the future.
I agree with you, Steph. And even looking back, UEFA and the member clubs should have been able to see this coming. I read this great book last year. It's called The Club. It's by Joshua Robinson and Jonathan Clegg. It's all about the formation of the English Premier League. And the last couple sentences of this book, I'm just going to read it. Picture a Champions League-type tournament featuring the biggest clubs in Europe, supercharged by a fresh influx of television rights money, playing one another year-round and not bothering to deal with the smaller clubs that used to clog up their schedule, not unlike what goes on stateside every summer in the ICC. But above all, it would look like the richest clubs in England deciding once and for all that they weren't getting their due, that they simply wouldn't carry the burden of the poorer, smaller, less popular clubs any longer. In other words, it would look an awful lot like 1992. I think that this has been a long time coming. There have been rumors and rumblings of it for a long time, and it's just finally been announced. And I agree with you. I couldn't be more interested to see where this goes.
With that said, I think it's time we join our friends on the first panel. Welcome, everyone, to part one of the Super League Symposium panel. I'm joined by Taryn Sharma and Stephanie Weisenberger. I'm also joined by two special guests, Gregory Termole and Keenan Haverford. So before we get into the fun, I'm just going to do some just quick introductions. You guys know Taryn and Stephanie. Greg Termole, we're going to say is a Belgium fan, but is a New York Red Bulls number one team. And then Keenan over there, he's joined us all the way from lovely Edinburgh, Scotland, and his favorite team is Hibs. So That said, we are all convening. This is the law school edition of the Avengers. Everyone is convened here with their special powers. We are here because of a very big announcement on the Super League front. So, Taryn, give us a quick background on kind of what happened, and then we'll break into the questions.
Big clubs have decided that they don't like the way that UEFA is running the league anymore, and they don't like the proposed changes, the so-called Swiss model. So the 12 of the top teams, I think they account for something like 80% of all of the European Cup wins, have united to form what is called the Super League. And they anticipate adding three more members and having five rotating members. So 20 teams split into two groups of 10, and they'll play double round robin and then go through the knockout phase as typical. But they would make more money because they don't have to worry about being relegated down from this competition.
Okay, so that's the gist of it. And Taryn, it's important to lay up. Been around for about half a century. Greg and Keenan, I'm going to open this up to you guys. You guys are you're coming new, fresh to the podcast. Keenan, I'm going to start with you over in Scotland. Tell me what the thoughts are on the ground with respect to the formation of the Super League.
Scotland, the Scottish Football Association, they're very against this, obviously. Not only were Scottish clubs not invited, but also the entire idea is against the concept and everything that Scottish football stands for. The two biggest teams in Scotland, Celtic and Rangers, they're very politically active, which is not as common for other countries, I guess. And for the rest of the UK, the government has condemned the entire Super League idea. The Prime Minister is trying to find ways to make it so these clubs cannot go through with it. He's proposing a similar model to the one they have in Germany, where the fans have to own 51% of the club. And when they do that, then they can vote out to not go through with the Super League. And yeah, that's that.
Keenan, can I ask you this? Are Celtic and Ranger, are they normally in the UEFA Cup?
Yeah, Rangers and Celtic, yeah, they are. They usually are.
So I guess your objection or issue with it is that you're basically cheapening UEFA if you're taking those top teams out and forming their own league and not allowing certain clubs to enter.
Exactly. They're locking them out from so much money because I think the rights for the Champions League for TV are coming to renegotiation soon. And if a Super League exists without the top 12, 15, 20 clubs, then the money that smaller teams from Scotland get would be so much less.
That's a fair point, and I was not even thinking of it from a certain level. I know we've heard comments from French government, English government, that all the governments seem to be opposed to this. Greg, let me turn it over to you. I know you're a Red Bull fan, but you're also Belgian and you have some ties to Lukaku. What are your thoughts about this on a World Cup level? Because as we've seen, you know, and mind you, I think a lot of people listening to this podcast tune in for the World Cup. I watch every single second of every single game. But, you know, obviously the UEFA president is threatening to ban players and that compete in the Super League. So as you, someone that obviously you're, you know, you're a domestic soccer fan, but you also have obviously ties overseas. What are your thoughts on the impact on the World Cup?
Yeah, that could be, in my opinion, one of the biggest impacts, because if they were actually to ban some of these players that are playing in the Super League, you would look at players like Messi and Ronaldo. Let's look at the next World Cup in 2022, where, you know, arguably the two best players ever may not even be able to compete in this World Cup since they play in Super League teams. I'm not really sure as to whether UEFA or FIFA will go through with that, because in my opinion, it's just a lot of lost money on their end and on the end of Qatar, who were awarded the 2022 World Cup. That to me would be the biggest problem, is that you'd see a lot of the big players, a lot of the big teams, they'd be missing about half their players. Like you look at the Portuguese team, they'd be missing about half their players. The France team, they'd be missing over half their players. So it's a lot of missing players and top talented players that wouldn't be able to play in the World Cup or even the Euros.
Greg, Keenan, this is why we have you guys on, because we're covering a lot of angles to this. And obviously, you know, football is the biggest sport in the world. So it's going to hit a number of angles. There's obviously, you know, the UEFA angle, there's a World Cup angle, but I guess the first topic I wanted to kind of get to on a sports level, and I'm really just kind of trying to go in order of like red alarms going off and like things, you know, obviously the World Cup's not tomorrow, we don't have to worry about it, but the Europa Cup and the Champions League, those are ongoing as we speak. So I'm going to open this up to the panel. Anybody's free to join in. I know this because I've done a black hole of research in the last probably 24 hours, but can someone kind of just like explain what is planned to happen? I mean, I'll just, for people that are following the news, I think it's the Danish president. He's maybe the president of the Danish Football Association, and he's on the board, the UEFA board, basically said that they're going to ban these Super League teams on Friday. So today we're recording this on Monday. By the end of the week, there's going to be teams that are banned from these, you know, I think it's Champions League. I don't know if we've heard on Europa, but I'm going to open it up to you guys on the floor. Assuming a ban does occur, which I think UEFA would be in their right to do it, what happens to the Europa League and what happens to Champions League?
There's only four teams left in Champions League right now. And the only one that is not belonging to this so-called Super League would be Paris Saint-Germain. So I guess they would...
PSG, as the kids say.
PSG would be the last team remaining. Now, one thing I could see is that they could take the other three teams that are in the Super League that are still in the Champions League. Maybe they take whoever they beat in the last round and have them play in the semifinals instead to replace, to still have, you know, the semifinals and the final rather than just awarding PSG the Champions League title.
I mean, it's just wild. It's almost like we're doing playground rules and like some kids had to go in for lunch or like their parents had to pick them up and we have to like reorganize the finals. Like this is not, it's not unlike anything I've ever heard of in sports. Am I wrong? Like I can't imagine that this has happened before where you're like, hey, you guys lost. Just kidding. Here's your second shot. This is double round robin. You're back in.
Well, that's why it seems like a bit of a bluff to me. Saying Friday means that the negotiation window is open until Friday to reach some sort of agreement. I just can't imagine that they're going to give up because there will be disputes with their TV partners if they don't play those games. And it would be an issue with the Europa League games as well. So I don't see that happening. I don't see it happening really for the World Cup either, because something that Greg mentioned also is just that it's going to cheapen the competition if your best players are not available to play.
I have a question for you guys. What do you think about, I know Taryn mentioned before that they just announced they changed the model to a Swiss model, and that was announced today. Is that right? So what do you think the timing has to do with that? You know, making this announcement of this Super League, do you think they did that on purpose? Was it strategic to overshadow UEFA's plan to ratify this newly designed Champions League to kind of be like, look, this is what's really going to happen. This Champions League news doesn't really matter because we're not going to be a part of it anymore. What do you think? Is there any strategic background to that, do you think?
I don't think so at all, because the Super League thing has been going on. Like, it's a discussion that's been going on for a while. It's actually been leaked that, like, even back in 2018, they had started the organization of it. And then now with the Champions League announcing this new format, this had been in the works already. I mean, maybe that they announced it today rather than, you know, next week. That could definitely be a timing thing, but I do believe this has been scheduled for a while. So anyway, the Super League has overshadowed pretty much anything that UEFA has come out to say. So
I think that they are related. I think that they didn't, these big clubs didn't want to sign on with the Swiss model. The Swiss model basically adds four more teams, so that brings it to 36. You would be playing extra games. Every team that makes it deep in the tournament is required to play extra games. And it's already, and you guys watch it, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but some of the round robin group stage games do feel like a bit of a drag. The result is already known ahead of time. You know who's going to advance. And in the case of Liverpool, like Diego Jota, he ended up getting hurt in what was kind of a meaningless game. They knew that they were going to advance anyway.
Yeah, and kind of to piggyback off that, I just think there's a lot of match congestion at the moment with a lot of these added games. Like you said, they're adding on four more games. Of course, it's more revenue for UEFA, but at the same time, that's more games for the players to play. I mean, we've seen, especially with COVID, some of these teams like Real Madrid have 50-plus injuries this season because of all the matches they're playing. They're playing 2-3 matches a week, which even if you're a professional, that's just a lot of games to play.
I honestly think the new Champions League model is way less interesting than the one we have with all the group stages. No one's going to tune in to watch those games, especially without the top 12 clubs. And the Super League format is similar in a way, and people would much rather see that. So I think the timing of the announcement was strategic, because then people can see the announcement today for the Champions League, they can just see that, oh, this new model doesn't sound as interesting as the Super League, and they just forgive the Super League people for having an even better model than the new Champions League.
Just to kind of echo, I mean, we've talked about the Champions League. The other league that seems to be impacted by this is the Europa League. So I'm, at least per sources, I think two teams, I think Arsenal and Man U are in the Europa League as it currently stands. And if they were to leave and be exiled, as at least as, I don't think it's been threatened on the Europa League front, but I'm sure by the end of this podcast, we'll have an update. But I think the final over in the Europa League would be Villarreal and Roma. So my question to you guys, I mean, as someone like, you know, I play English Premier League fantasy. Obviously, I've played FIFA my entire life in some way, shape, or form. But, you know, I guess from a gameplay standpoint, and Keenan, I'd love your thoughts on this too. People play in the normal course of the season. You're trying to avoid relegation, but on the top end of the table, you're trying to make it to various leagues, be it the Champions League or the Europa League, right? So if you're in the Premier League, you know, finishing second through fourth has certain implications, and finishing fifth through seventh has implications. I am not sure what it does to gameplay if half the teams that are in the Premier League, not half the teams, but a certain amount of teams, it doesn't really matter how they perform because they're still in this Super League and they're playing it during the week. What do you think that has on gameplay purposes? I don't know how that's going to look like.
Yeah, I agree. It's going to look terrible. The teams are not going to put in any effort. They're probably going to field their worst 11 players. They're not going to care as much. And then it also devalues the entire league. The rest of the teams would not enjoy that at all. And we know the Premier League TV rights are coming. The negotiations are coming in super soon. And if the broadcasters see that the Premier League is not as competitive as it used to be, they're not going to pay as much, which is going to hurt the entire English football pyramid. And it's...
So, I mean, on that, this is me being a just a general sports fan. I mean, I was watching the updates come in. The Italian league had an emergency meeting with Serie A today, and that I guess AC Milan, Inter Milan, and Juventus are supposed to be in these Super League teams. And they had this emergency meeting, and I don't think anybody knew whether those teams were going to stay in the Spanish league or if they were going to go to the Super League. And I think they've said that their intention is to play in both leagues simultaneously. So I don't know if, I mean, is there a world where these teams just defect from their baseline leagues and they don't play in the English Premier League and they just go to the Super League? Is that, I'll open that up to the floor. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, if you're banned from, if UEFA, right, controls the domestic leagues and they ban you from this league, I mean, is there a world where there's no more English, you know, no more Arsenal and Man U in the Premier League and they're just playing in the Super League?
That could happen, but that's the thing where I don't see how it makes sense, because who is really going to watch that much of the Premier League without the big six? They are the biggest clubs. They have the biggest fan bases. That's really who people tune in to watch, whether they're rooting for them or rooting against them. I think that drives a lot of the interest in the league. It's the same reason why in 1992, like, the Premier League is founded because those clubs decided to leave. And that they wanted more TV money. They didn't want to be like overseen by the FA. It bears a ton of similarity to what is happening right now, just with, in addition to those big six clubs, also clubs from other leagues, the big clubs from other leagues.
Yeah, I agree. I just don't see a world where teams like Man U, Liverpool, Man City, et cetera, aren't playing in the Premier League because, A, that's just another stream of revenue for them. It's another stream of revenue for the English FA, for UEFA, for everyone involved. And then as Taryn said, it's, you know, I love football, but I'm not going to wake up and watch Crystal Palace, Burnley every week or teams of that nature play when there's no Man City, Man U. As much as I love it, I prefer to watch better players. I prefer to watch top teams.
I mean, just to push back on that, Taryn, I have a friend who's a very big Sheffield United fan. He has his own Sheffield United.
Blades. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're crazy. I mean, there's three different English, there are three different English leagues. So, I mean, at least within England, right? Like, yeah. I don't know, maybe there's a world where like Aston Villa and like Crystal Palace and whoever else is just duking it out. Maybe there's still a model and just from the NFL model, like I saw someone on Twitter and Greg is a follower of the podcast on Twitter. He can relate. There is a meme that I saw going around, like, explain this to me like I'm five, like the scene from The Office. Like, this is not necessarily English for a lot of, you know, major sports fans in the United States. With that said, like, we all follow the NFL, at least in some way, shape, or form. And Keenan, I might be coming to you with this question to kind of make sense of this, because Keenan, do you follow American football?
I follow the NBA, so if you want to...
Okay, that works.
Metaphor of that.
So the NFL plays, you know, every Sunday, right? Every Sunday they play a little bit on Monday. They don't play games during the week. They especially don't play in like a separate league that exists in and of itself. When you want to find the standings and then you want to find when your team is playing, you literally just look at one schedule and that's it. I know because I was having a lot of trouble this when I first started playing English Premier League soccer, that my players, for whatever reason, were very tired because they were playing all these different games across the country. So Keenan, can you just maybe for people that just aren't kind of following this, can you explain how the gameplay and the schedule would work out as at least it's being proposed with games, you know, be it on Saturday and Sunday, and then the Super League as it's being proposed is a midweek league. So can you kind of explain how that would look like and maybe how that differs from normal structure of a schedule?
So the things are right now, I doubt it's going to be as different because right now, teams, at least in England, they play the league on the weekend, and then midweek they usually either have the EFL Cup, English Football League Cup, or the FA Cup, or Champions League to play for at least the big six teams. So they're already playing almost every week a midweek game. So it's not going to differ that much unless it's going to be every single week and like two games each midweek probably. But no, it shouldn't differ when it comes to player fitness. I don't think so.
Okay, so you basically think that because teams are used to playing during the week, that it's not really going to make that much difference on the underlying leagues, the extent that they can stay in their hometown and domestic leagues?
Yeah, exactly. I doubt it would.
Guys, if the NBA did this, who would be the teams that left? I'm trying to just figure this out in my head. Would it be like Lakers?
Celtics, Knicks, yeah.
Chicago.
Yeah, all the big markets probably.
Yeah, exactly.
Because, I mean, Stephanie and I were talking about this offline. Like, honestly, Keenan, to your point, if you just take those teams and they're playing, you know, in the Super League as opposed to the Europa League or the Champions League, and they're still staying in their hometown league, I don't really think it has that much of a difference on TV deals. Maybe.
But Dan, the thing is that, like, the NBA is already the Super League. You wouldn't have teams leaving the NBA. In this case, the NBA is already a closed-off league. There's no threat of relegation. So that's basically what these owners of these big clubs want to do with the Super League. A closed off thing where 15 of them just don't have to leave.
But couldn't they still get relegated in their original league that they're coming from? Isn't that Keenan's point?
Yeah, but would that matter? Because they get to play for the big money thing anyway. One of the biggest reasons that you want to achieve well in the domestic league, even if you don't win it, is so that you can get to European football. And if you can do that, regardless, if you're guaranteed that anyway, I think it cheapens all of the domestic competition. The way that people treat the FA Cup or the Carabao Cup or the League Cup now, they could end up treating the Premier League like that.
I'm fascinated by it, Greg. I'm gonna turn it to you because I think we understand the NBA, NFL. Greg has admitted this podcast is public, so everyone's gonna know it at a certain point. Greg is a big MLS fan. It's his favorite league. Greg, maybe that's the closest comparison. I don't know if this has an impact on the MLS. Obviously, they're not playing the Champions League again, Europa League. Probably has some type of an impact on Greg, I'm going to give you a wild card here, right? Let's play this scenario, Ellen. Taryn, you're smiling. You have no idea what I'm about to say right now, right? I am a citizen of the United States. I would love to see the United States win a World Cup at some point. Greg, I'm going to turn it to you. Doesn't this help the United States' chances of winning a World Cup if all these players are banned?
Yes and no, because if
yes and no.
All the players are banned, yes, but half of our team is on these teams. If you look at Man City, they have a starting keeper, Zach Steffen. Starting right back plays for Barcelona, Sergiño Dest. Starting left wing plays for Chelsea, Christian Pulisic. Weston McKennie, starting center mid, plays for Juventus. And then we obviously have to see the three other teams involved. So, in a sense, it helps because it weakens the other national teams, but at the same time, it does weaken the American national team.
But it weakens them much more. Their whole teams get wiped, and we might have like some scrubby, shitty guys.
No. The other teams have way more depth because look at France; they're missing half their team, but they still have Mbappe. So, no one on the you could put 10 guys in the box on Mbappe; he's not being stopped.
Keenan, I have same question for you. Doesn't this? Listen. I think I know what your answer is, but doesn't this maybe help Scotland win a World Cup?
No, we're terrible enough. Trust me, we're terrible enough.
barely make it to the Euros against the worst teams.
Well, that was before the Super League, but now I see.
Yeah, we're playing against Estonia, and I doubt Estonia have any players in the champion in the Super League. But yeah, it does give other teams a better chance in a way. But realistically, like say Brazil, they've got insane depth. Even if you wipe out the first 11, this can pull up 11 that can probably demolish Scotland and the US combined.
Yeah.
So I should not bet $1,000 on the United States and Scotland to win the World Cup. I should not do that.
Maybe you should, because gambling is fun.
I have a question really fast, though. Just in terms of we're talking about the money and whatnot, if I'm going to play devil's advocate and I'm going to be Manchester United or Barcelona, why shouldn't they break away and keep all the money for themselves? UEFA gets all the revenue and apportions some of it to the teams, but there's rumbling saying that the founding clubs of this Super League would split $3.5 billion in euros, which is almost $4.2 billion for signing on to establish a sustainable financial foundation, which would mean that the per team figure, each founding club would receive about $400 million, which is more than four times what the Champions League winner took home in 2020. So if I'm Manchester United, Barcelona, one of these top teams, why wouldn't I want to break away from what's going on right now?
That's a great point, and I'm really glad that you brought that up, Steph. That there are major issues with UEFA, and UEFA is a very corrupt organization. So it's not really like one side is really good and the other side is really bad. In this case, you have like two sides that are trying to get more of what they think they're owed. And so in this case, the big clubs feel that they're bringing all of the eyeballs. They're putting their assets on the line and playing these games. So why should UEFA leech out such a significant portion of that? So in that sense, it makes sense. But you can recognize that there are major issues, and even with the financial thing is a big reason. So they tried to implement something called financial fair play, FFP, and that was supposed to limit the seemingly bottomless pit that clubs like PSG and Man City can spend on players and these record transfer fees. But that hasn't happened. They haven't been able to enforce that. So this seems like, if you take the owner's word for it, that they're trying to enforce financial limits on themselves. And this is the only way how that they can say, okay, 55% of revenue and we all have the same revenue. So if you believe that they're going to be able to police themselves, then maybe it does work out better. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like if you're one of these top clubs, you definitely want to try to break away because, I mean, it's just a lot more money. But I feel like it's just, you know, at the end of the day, it is a business, but at the same time, it's because of the fans. And I feel like they're going against what the fans believe. And even if you look at some of the mottos of these clubs, like Liverpool, you'll never walk alone. Barcelona, Mesquite club, bigger than a club. They're kind of going back on what their motto and what their club is built on and their history and tradition. And I think that's what a lot of people are upset about. And I mean, the fact that people are siding with UEFA and FIFA, with as corrupt as they've been, the fact that a lot of people are siding with them kind of goes to show just how bad this whole situation is.
That's something that you're going to lose is that these clubs, even though they're the biggest clubs now, they weren't always the biggest clubs. It wasn't more than probably 15 years ago that Liverpool was in administration and they could have easily been docked down a league or two, or that Juventus was in Serie B, or that Man City was like a third league team. And so these teams have made it and now they want to pull up the drawbridge behind them. And that just doesn't seem fair. Part of the reason why the Champions League is so fun is much like why the NCAA tournament is so fun, that you get to see the UMBCs or Oral Roberts or whoever make these runs and really captivate the imagination of smaller clubs of what could be possible. And even in the last few years, you've seen teams like Monaco, teams like Atalanta, teams like Lyon last year. They're not necessarily huge clubs, but they've made deep runs, and that's really exciting for their fans. That's really exciting for the neutral fans to be able to see these clubs that you don't normally see. And something that Jurgen Klopp, the Liverpool manager, said a couple of years ago when this Super League idea was first leaked, as Greg mentioned, is that who really wants to see Real Madrid and Liverpool play for the next 10 years? part of the excitement is that they have to go through all of the teams to get to those big matchups. And that may not be the case if you have the Super League. It's almost assuredly that it won't be the case.
I guess this is a good point, and we've hit a lot here. I think the one maybe topic that we haven't discussed is the player's role in all this. And obviously for part two of the panel, we're going to go into more of the legal side of this. But I guess from a, you know, a fan standpoint, just so everyone's aware, I don't think the players don't really have any say in what their team's going to do ahead of time. Obviously, they can have any number of things they could do, right? We've talked about wildcat strikes on this podcast in the NBA, Keenan, which you will remember from the Milwaukee Bucks situation last year when they walked out on the court. So I guess, you know, I think it's important, right? Your team is going to dictate basically your action. It seems like a lot of these teams defected, and I'm not sure players were necessarily in support of it. I saw videos from former players that were saying that they were not in support of it. And maybe the current players can't speak up, but the actions of their team are going to have a lot of ramifications on their earnings and the way they're viewed maybe in their home country. So Keenan, I'm going to turn it to you. What are your thoughts on this? I mean, as far as I'm aware, there's no like controlling CBA for international matters. There's no way for these players to collectively bargainize on an international level outside of their own league. So maybe you can kind of explain to us what rights the players have. I know there was a union that piped up for a little bit, but I'm kind of in the dark with respect to what if anything would apply to help the players fight this.
Yeah, exactly. There's no strong union or anything similar to the CBA where they can really negotiate or anything where they can make an impact. They just have to go along with whatever their teams are doing. And I think that's not the most fair thing, especially if they get banned from the Euros or the World Cup. I mean, it's not your fault that your team agreed to do something. I mean, you're not going to get paid more just because of that. And you're not going to, it's just unfair. I can, like, players, they grow up and they want to win the Champions League. They've never dreamed of the Super League. And I doubt they're going to care as much for winning something like the Super League because there's no prestige behind it.
On a related note, and I don't know the answer to this question. I know, and obviously in domestic sports, we have any number of scenarios where a superstar will demand a trade from a particular team. I know in certain markets, there's a transfer window that occurs from point A to point B, and you can't get transferred outside of that window. Is there a world, Keenan, maybe to your last point, like where players are going to say, hey, I don't want any part of this? And I know, Tottenham fired their manager, you know, maybe from some, if you want to believe the rumor mill, that he didn't want Tottenham to defect. But is there any type of world where players demand transfers off of teams that are going to the Super League?
They can put in a transfer request, but there are many circumstances where a player would put in a transfer request and they stay on the team. They either get benched or just never play. So really, there's no way to force a trade like there is in the NBA.
Well, the Rockets could have done that to James Harden, but they did not.
Yeah, that's true.
I was going to ask that. Do either of you think that there's a scenario in which clubs like Bayern or Dortmund or PSG that haven't signed on to the Super League yet, as of this recording, might become more popular destinations because they would still be playing for the Champions League?
I will say before you answer that, because I see your head was moving, you're about to answer. I think the report, Taryn, and just so we can cover ourselves if there is breaking news, invitations extended to those three teams in particular to join the Super League, and I think it's in 15 to 30 days. So I don't. There's a scenario where the floodgates are just open and the Super League can just be a behemoth, right? It can be any number of teams. So I don't know. Let's phrase it as this, Greg. Same question. Teams that don't leave because we don't, right? Taryn, we don't know, right? Tomorrow PSG could be in the Super League. Greg, do you think that it's going to help the popularity of non-Super League teams? Because I don't normally get this on my timeline. Liverpool fans are protesting. I'm seeing it all over the place that fans really are not in support of this. So, I mean, does this give a sizable bump maybe in TV deals, revenue to the non-Super League teams?
In terms of TV deals, I think if anything, it might lower it. Because if you're looking at the Prem, it's a $2 billion or £2 billion TV deal. A lot of that money is because, you know, you have your Man U's, your Liverpool's, Arsenal, Chelsea, all that. Now, in terms of Liga and Bundesliga, those might stay the same if no teams defect. In terms of popularity, it's kind of tough to tell because I assume if you're a Super League team, you'll be able to afford much higher wages due to the more money coming in. So for that, you might see players, you know, at the end of the day, they have to make a living for their family as much as they love the sport. You know, their family comes first. Making money is probably always going to come first because your football career is only so long. So it's tough to tell. If I had to guess, I would say they might gain a little less popularity because the Champions League won't be as coveted either. That would just be my guess.
That seems like it could be more like if you're a top high school recruit, like you could play anywhere, but you're almost more likely to choose one of those schools that's regularly in the college football playoff, whether it be Alabama or Ohio State, Clemson, those schools, Oklahoma.
Okay, so I think this will put this in the books. I'm going to give it to everyone. Everyone can get on their soapbox and give us their parting thoughts. Keenan, I'm going to start with you. So, you know, as we're leaving, and obviously today's Monday, a lot can change in the next couple of days. We have this looming threat for Friday. Give us your overall parting thoughts, how this will impact the sport, what you'd like to see happen, and if it doesn't, you know, what potentially could come of this?
On a commercial level, I think it makes sense. If I own one of those teams, I'd for sure go for it. But in terms of culture, I mean, at least here in the UK, football is such a big thing here for the culture. People support their local teams. And with the Super League, attendance would really go down for most games. And the entire culture is like commercializing this much, such a cultural thing in a country. It's never a good thing. And I strictly oppose it.
Stephanie, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think kind of going back to what you guys were saying about how there's no real players association like there is in the NBA or NFL, that maybe this might prompt UEFA or FIFA to kind of become more involved and more communicatory with the players and kind of give them more of a say, because I think that is one of the things that has worked well and also hurt, obviously, the NFL and NBA in the past. But the fact that there's no real governing body that allows the players to communicate with UEFA, and it's kind of just up to the owners and whatever they decide, I think this might be a wake-up call to UEFA if the Super League actually does end up happening. I don't know if it actually will, but I think having more of a players association, something like that, would definitely benefit in the future if they wanted to keep the Premier League and Champions League up and running.
Greg, your final thoughts?
Yeah, it's actually a good point that you brought up, Stephanie. I didn't really think of that, but just as a fan, I feel like it's a sad day if it were to continue to go through. Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen. We could wake up tomorrow morning and, you know, they agree on not having it. But if it were to happen, I just think it kind of takes some of the beauty out of the sport. A quote that I have here that I wrote down is, one of the reasons football is the most popular sport in the world is because the weak can beat the powerful, as said by Leeds manager Marcelo Bielsa. I mean, as Taryn mentioned, you see these comebacks, the drama in UCL, and even in domestic leagues, you look at Leicester, 5,001 odds to win the Premier League. They did it. Elvis Presley's odds of being alive were 2,500-1. So it kind of tells you just how crazy those odds were. But that's kind of what makes this sport so great, is that you can, you know, it's not played on paper. It's not like some other sports where you kind of know what's going to happen. You really just don't know what's going to happen on any given day.
And Taryn, send us home.
Yeah, so many good points have been made, and it's a really great discussion. I think that as a whole, this plan really kills competition. And as somebody who's a sports fan first, I'm most interested in having those stories. Sports is at its best when you have great stories. And I like Liverpool, but it's not people like me who built the club. It's not people like John Henry, all respect to them, that built the club. It's the people in Liverpool, the people like Shankly, who built the club. And the things that they've been saying that I've been following is that it's not all about winning. And it's about the journey. Sometimes it's about losing. It's about that tension, that drama. And it's about earning the place. And that really fits with the blue-collar mentality of that city. And it's their club, and I think that the leadership ought to listen.
I'll have the last word. Taryn, you kind of apropos say it's about winning, it's about history. The Super League, Taryn, unlike the words that you just said, seems to be all about the Benjamins. Am I right, team? Am I right?
Right.
Okay, so I want to thank you all for joining us. Greg, appreciate it, and Keenan, all the way from Scotland. Hopefully it's not too late on your end, but super appreciate all of you guys jumping on such short notice. And yeah, so that will put the panel one in the books. So that was panel one. Guys, what do you think?
was so great to hear what the feeling was on the ground. There's obviously a lot of angst in the UK, and you can see that playing out all over social media and in demonstrations outside of the grounds. And it's just going to be really interesting to see what the clubs make of all of this. Steph?
Yeah, I totally agree. It's definitely interesting to hear the fan side of things from someone who is over in that neck of the woods across the pond and what they're kind of feeling over there, because obviously this is a tradition. European football has been,
you know. How do you pronounce the country where Keenan is from?
Scotland.
Okay, there you got that. You can't pronounce football, but you got Scotland. Cool, got it.
Edinburgh, Scotland.
You got it. Right? I'm shocked. You're one for two. Excellent.
All right. Well, you know, very excited that they were able to join us and provide some insight, because like I said before, I don't really follow the Premier League, Champions League that much. And so it's very different than the leagues that we have over here in America in terms of structure. So it was great to hear their perspectives.
So, yeah, I mean, just as we transition to our second panel. So that was really the sports side of this. This is a sports law podcast. So, and a lot of people have sports podcasts. And Greg also told me offline he has a Red Bulls podcast, which if I can find at some point, we'll share that. But this podcast has, our dedicated listenership because we bring the legal side of it. So for our second panel, and I just so everyone's clear, I told everyone in the first panel, let's try to stay away from legal topics. Let's save that for the second panel so we can set the stage. So again, this is the Super League Symposium. Normally we have, if we ever did a symposium, we have a couple panels, but you know what? This is going to bring some heavy hitters. First and foremost, we have Kat Pejlidovic. I'm going to definitely mispronounce that, and she'll correct me, I'm sure. She's the author of EU Sports Law and Breakaway Leagues in Football. She's a professor at Manchester Law School. I cannot think of a more perfect guest for this topic than her. She was recommended by at least three people in my DM, so we had to have her on, and she definitely accommodated. You know, we also have Stephen Bank, who's a UCLA law professor, again, recommended by a ton of people. And then also Ted Curtis, recommended by a couple people. He's a sports management professor over at Lynn University. And last but not least, we have a listener of Conduct Detrimental. That's Tom Babcock. He's a New York State practicing attorney and a diehard soccer fan. So, you know, we had a bunch of professors on here. We didn't have a practicing lawyer on here. We have a couple law students. We have the whole legal community. We have a couple continents covered. So with that said, I'm going to turn it over to the panelists for panel number two. Welcome to panel two of the Super League Symposium. I am joined. We have a lot of people on this one. We will start. Ted Curtis is a sports management professor at Lynn University. Ted, I'm going to give you the floor to explain a little bit about what you do. But let me go down the line and then everyone can kind of have their own. Stephen Banks, a professor at UCLA, is an international sports law professor, also teaches business law. Tom Babcock is a practicing attorney in New York State that does some writing for the lovely Columbus Crew. He might get on his soapbox and tell us to save the crew. Maybe, possibly. And last but not least, we have Katarina. I'm going to have you pronounce your last name for us, but Katarina is probably the perfect person to have for this panel, having wrote a book particularly on this topic. That said, Katarina, I'm going to start with you. Give us the pronunciation of your last name, because I'm not going to butcher it, but I want you to explain the book that you wrote on this and maybe just your initial impressions of what we're dealing with.
Right. So the book is called The EU Sports Law and Breakaway Leagues in Football. It was published in 2012. And the pronunciation of my name is Pietlovic, and I'm not surprised that nobody can get it right. So that's not a problem.
Maybe the other guys, the other guys credit that they would have done it. I am going to admit that there was no chance I would have got that right.
So the initial thoughts is, as I've been talking to a lot of people today, that first of all, this isn't really a new thing. The breakaway threats have been happening since 1998, since Silvio Berlusconi's proposal through the Media Partners International to the G14, which is a group of elite clubs. And the clubs, the way that UEFA reacted to that proposal to take away these clubs from the UEFA structures was to reform Champions League, enabling more spots for the clubs from the Big Five leagues. And this is when the clubs got the idea, oh, so I can do this every single time. I can just break away, I can just threaten to break away, and the UEFA will bend and make some concessions for us. We will get more say in the governance. We will get more money. and so on, and more spots for the teams. So this isn't a new thing. What makes it different this time is that, and we've seen this replay almost every year or every other year with nothing really happening. But this time we have 12 clubs resigning from the European Club Association, which is essentially the union of clubs that was run very inappropriately, I would say, by the elite for the elite. And this club association has gotten a seat on your UEFA club competition committee, through which they have controlled the European football, the club football, that is. So the fact that clubs have resigned from such an important vehicle for the control of the European football governance, I consider that something quite unexpected. And there is also, if you have heard reports of the lawsuits filed to prevent UEFA and FIFA from implementing the threats to ban the clubs from domestic leagues.
That's breaking news to me. As much as I'm trying to file this, I did not hear of lawsuits that were filed to try to stop this. Is that today that lawsuits were filed?
Much earlier today, yes. This was reported by Tariq Pine of New York Times. And he has just sent a tweet saying that there are multiple lawsuits filed, and I presume it is in the countries where the clubs come from. So the three countries, only Italy, Spain, and England. And I presume it was a request for interim order that can be done quickly by the court to prevent the damage from being done, which is, it's a massive legal and financial and practical risk that the Super League clubs are taking.
Obviously, we have a ton to unpack. Let's do introductions quick, and then we'll get into the meat. Ted, tell us a little bit about your overall thoughts of this and your initial impressions.
This is, without a doubt, earth-shattering, groundbreaking. And this is the kind of thing that 50 years from now, we're going to come back and study. Because this is the moment when 150 years worth of European soccer governance may change permanently and forever. I find this absolutely fascinating. And we can talk about the things that it can compare to and whether or not any of the things from the past can give us an idea as to what's going to happen in the future.
Stephen, I'm going to turn it over to you too. And that's why Ted and Stephen, I have you guys here, as we'll say they're professors/historians. But I guess, Stephen, given Ted's comments, I guess tell us a little bit your initial impressions, if there's anything that comes to mind. I know you and I spoke offline, but you've done a lot of coverage of the women's professional soccer lawsuit for their World Cup. I have a feeling, that these lawsuits might even be bigger than that. As much as that was covered here, the women's national team issues are obviously a domestic issue. It's not an international issue. So I guess, what are your thoughts on how big this could be and how this compares to some historical soccer precedent?
So Dan, I would put this, as Katarina said, I would say in some sense, this isn't new, but I would place it in a different context. So it's not new. Breakaway leagues aren't new. But what is new about this is the legal context has changed pretty dramatically in recent years. So start out with there's a variety of cases that in the European arena where there have been challenges to the authority of international sports governing bodies to exercise what has previously been kind of a superpower. Like powers, almost independent sovereignty, like powers, and it starts out even with the U.S. indicting FIFA, but you have an International Skating Union big case that was confirmed back in December of 2020, and you have the FINA, the International Swimming Governing Body, which is an antitrust case in the U.S. That FINA has relented on and allowed swimmers to compete in non-sanctioned activity. So I think, broadly, there is a threat to international governing bodies. It exists in the U.S. There's a case by Relevant Sports trying to host La Liga matches in the U.S. There's a lot of this reflects a trend towards multinationalism that sports hasn't quite figured out yet, and the law is probably ahead of where the popular opinion is, and so that's going to be a challenge for FIFA and UEFA, even if they were to resist this tie.
Okay, Tom, let me get your overall thoughts. Obviously, you're hitting a cleanup here. So, tell us your thoughts here. And obviously, you're on here for being the domestic soccer fan. I think part of why that there's a challenge to this, guys, I live and breathe on Twitter. Someone had a thread that went viral. Explain this to me in NFL terms. Explain this to me in college football terms. And then I saw a lot of the GIF from Steve Carell in The Office explain it to me like I'm five. This is a very complicated topic that's touching upon Europa finals, Champions League finals, the Premier League, the La Liga, the Spanish League. You know, it's a very complicated topic that doesn't, you know, to Steve's point, doesn't really find that many analogous scenarios in United States sports. So maybe you can, just as your opening thoughts, tell us how this would kind of look like on a domestic landscape. What is there even any a way to compare this, right? Is it like the Lakers leaving, you know, some comment? I have no idea how to really, it's such a high level learning curve to explain this to somebody.
Yeah, I think that's really the key point, is the fact that there really isn't anything super analogous to, you know, US-based fans, because of the fact that you're talking about, you know, multiple countries, multiple regions. You know, I don't want to reiterate the great points that have already been said, but I think another interesting thing that I find in here, you know, has been some of the talk about when you're looking at things like issues with labor law, for example, some of the issues regarding the players and whether or not they'll be able to compete for their national teams. You see some of this reporting coming out from UEFA and FIFA saying that those clubs will not be allowed to participate, and the legality of that is being, you know, discussed. But I think that, you know, in terms of the scope of this, I mean, you're talking about just an incomparable scope to something that we're dealing with here in the US, not only because of the fact that you're dealing in this case with multiple countries, but you're also dealing with so many issues at once. But ironically, this kind of move to this Super League, even though the process isn't something that's analogous, the teams that are going to be in this league permanently is something that's much more of a US-based system that you see, where you see, you know, for example, like the NFL, those teams in the NFL don't leave. And that's kind of the concept, you know, that the Super League is kind of introducing with these 12 teams, is that they'll get to stay no matter what the results are. And then you have other teams that quote unquote qualify once it comes in. So I think, yeah, there's just an incredible scope in terms of this getting into the Super League here.
So I guess this is where I really wanted to start the conversation. And Tom, you brought it up. There's particular, I don't know if it's necessarily antitrust issues, if it's I don't know if it's players that are going to be filing these lawsuits, but where at least my heart as a fan of all things sports kind of lies, these are decisions that are being made at an executive level. And we'll say at the billionaire level, right? Not at the millionaire level. To leave the Premier League and to go to the Super League is not a decision that the defenders and the team are making, or the goalkeeper, the striker. It's a decision that's being made at a much higher level. So as far as I'm aware, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, there is no functional equivalent of, like, at least in terms of strength, as Major League Baseball's union, right? Or even the NBA, the National Basketball Players Association, that could really, you know, maybe effectuate some type of a strike to really get their way. Or even, you know, we were talking in our first panel, James Harden's a player with the Houston Rockets who essentially forced his way out of town when he wanted a trade from the Rockets. But as we've seen in the history of international football, a guy can put a transfer request in, but the team is pretty much okay kind of putting a guy on the bench and not playing him. So I'm going to open this up to the panel. I'm not sure what a player does in this instance. If they really have an issue and they want to play in the World Cup, and they're being right now threatened to not being able to play in the World Cup, and they're not okay with what's going on. Obviously, you know, if you want to buy the rumor mill, Tottenham lost their manager because they didn't agree with the Super League move. Now, I don't know what happens on a player level, and I have to imagine what we've heard on the former player level, that there are a lot of current players that are not okay with this, but that are afraid to speak up. So I'm going to open this up to the panel. Do players have any legal remedies here?
Well, yes, I can just start.
Yeah, well, Stephen, well, you will know, and probably you all will know what the ISU case said. In essence, the general rule is that governing bodies do have right to impose sanctions on players for participating in unauthorized competitions. However, these sanctions are supposed to be proportionate and not arbitrary. So the question is, when UEFA and FIFA decide to ban players from competing in national teams, whether or not this is necessary and proportionate, whether it is necessary to the goal, which is to stop the breakaway league and the massive threat to the core values of European football, essentially, which is perceived like that from their point of view, or whether it is enough that they actually go after the clubs by banning them from domestic competitions. You can argue this either way, but players essentially do not have much say in where the club participates. So punishing them does seem a bit excessive. On the other hand, the threat is so massive that nothing like this has really happened, you know. So the threat is massive. If you put that on one side of the scale and you put the fact that players that are banned from national team competitions really don't have much of economic consequences. So it's not like ISU, where players are dependent for their living on those alternative competitions. Here, they are not really dependent in any sense. So you can argue that way. On the other hand, the exposure in World Cup and Euro does give a lot of, you know, it prompts a lot of young players and it launches their careers. We have seen that many times. You know, you can argue it either way. But if I had to guess, I would say that it's tad excessive.
I would add that the first issue is disproportionate. Especially existing players who are under contract to a team. It's not like the ISU case in that it's not players deciding where to compete. Like in ISU, they're deciding to enter a competition that was not sanctioned. These are not players who have any agency on that question of where their team operates. They're under existing contracts. That's the legal process. If you know, Dan, you asked, what could the players do now? There's two things. One is there is an organization, FIFPro, which ostensibly operates as a international players association. It's not the same as a union in the US. They don't have collective bargaining rights. Because it's multi-jurisdictional, it makes it really difficult under multiple labor laws to make any kind of real stand, but they could organize something, you know, akin to a boycott of some kind. The other issue, and I bet you agents right now are scouring all of their contracts to see whether any of them are contingent on playing in FIFA sanctioned competitions, because there are players who could suddenly become free agents. The contract declared void if they have contracts that have put in anything like that, like, you know, you're required to do that. So I would not be shocked if, you know, if this gets far enough along the way that some players will opt out on that grounds. Third thing is that I think in individual countries, you may see lawsuits, because if the U.S. is going to lose, you know, Christian Pulisic or, you know, any one of its stars, the antitrust case against the International Swimming Governing Body, is in U.S. court. That was filed in U.S. court. Would not be shocked if there's an antitrust case in the U.S. to allow U.S. players to play, arguing that UEFA is, you know, acting to bar them from U.S. competition. So those are three possible avenues, but it's not the same as collective bargaining agreement, not the same kind of collective power that you'd see in the U.S. sports.
I think too, you might also see, you know, there's a potential angle here as well of players kind of jumping on with what Steve had said about the contracts, players who have contract incentives based off of certain performance, you know, not just I'm going to stay at the club because as long as we are competing in the Champions League, for example, but that if I make 20 appearances for the club in the Champions League, I get 2 million euro, for example. And then you also talk about a loss of, you might see individuals, players and individual companies sue for potential loss of income, some type of, you know, not just the salary, but also the merchandising and the sponsorship deals that they have. You know, several players are tied, have, for example, sponsorship deals between shoe companies, you know, Nike or Adidas, that are closely linked with the national teams that they play for. And the reason that the players themselves have those deals is because they can maximize the amount of money they're making, because the national team and the individual player are wearing the same exact branding. So it's a potential that if you get kicked people out of these competitions, that they lose potential sponsorship revenue and may go to court in an individual country to say that this is preventing their ability to earn an income, or under some kind of contract violation, saying that the terms of their contract are being now voided.
So Steve, you brought up the topic that was my second topic, and Ted, I'm going to turn it over to you for the first shot at this one. The one side of the equation, obviously, is what can players do, what players, you know, legal remedies they have, right? Could they have a strike or whatnot? The term antitrust is being thrown around a lot in domestic culture, be it on the Major League Baseball level with their antitrust exemption being potentially taken away, the NCAA with their separate issues with antitrust liability. But, you know, we don't really hear antitrust and football or soccer. But I think that seems to be what's going on here. We have a lot of high-powered entities that are threatening bans and sanctions. And then, you know, that's when we talk about bans, we talk about that in the NCAA, the college football context. So Ted, I'm going to turn it over to you. What are the antitrust principles at play here, and how likely is it that we see an antitrust lawsuit come of this?
Well, we don't hear the term antitrust being thrown around, but we sure should. The European competition law is pretty clear in prohibiting any kind of collusion, any type of anti-competitive behavior. And the term market dominance is one that is used by the European Commission quite often, it sure feels like this, at least at first blush, falls squarely on that. The European competition law is not terribly unlike American antitrust law in that it prohibits anti-competitive behavior with limited pro-competitive effects. And I'm not sure I can think of anything that fits the bill more than taking 12 of the biggest competitors out of the 400 and making them the 800-pound gorilla.
Which way? Because you could say UEFA, by banning those clubs, would also be, you know, acting in concert to eliminate competition for their Champions League. You know, so which way does this cut?
Oh, isn't that going to be fun to find out?
Katarina, do you have any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, well, there are many competition issues indeed. And the you know, questions are clearly, you know, not the ones that you can give straight answers to. For, on the one hand, obviously clubs that are involved in the type of league like this, which is essentially closed league, even if they, you know, did allow for five places for promotion and relegation, which are essentially never going to really be very dynamic. You know, you are still going to have some of the richest teams constantly filling in those spots. The idea of 15 clubs not having to qualify, but just by virtue of them being those clubs, you know, having those spots is a big issue, because the access has to be based on objective criteria. You know, and here we had a group of clubs just to collect themselves, and, you know, there is no really reason for instance, for Spurs to be there and not Leicester or something like that. It doesn't have that objective feel to it. There is no objective criteria according to which clubs can actually enter the league. And once they do enter, they cannot fall out. Like, these 15 clubs cannot fall out of leagues, which means that we are seeing American-type closed leagues, which under European antitrust laws doesn't work because it prevents market access. The Sherman Act in the US is quite a bit different than this. So that is one issue. And you're right. Perhaps the attempt to block the domestic participation of domestic leagues does have its own competition implications. But on the other hand, there are things like, for instance, the legitimate objectives in public interest, which the UEFA is pursuing by such blocking them. You know, so that could be a good defense for UEFA. And if they can show that there is no other way possibly to prevent this, and I don't see any other way, that this was the least restrictive measure they could have possibly taken, so that therefore it's proportionate response to this threat, they can actually pretty much defend their action.
So in the U.S., when we talk about competition, we've had a lot of antitrust cases in sports. They're often about leagues competing against each other. You should, right. You know, you should have the USFL, should be able to compete. The ABA should be able to compete with the NBA, all of that. So in Europe, like, that's the way in the U.S. we think about it. Super League should be able to compete with the Champions League. Why not? You know, if everybody loves the Champions League, they'll gravitate to that. That's not the way they think about it in Europe. But that is a way to think about it. I mean, that's what's going on here. It's a Super League is saying, hey, we should be able to form a league. We're a business. They're a business, you know, and they have not ever grappled with that question in Europe, as far as I know, that question of sports leagues having competition versus sports clubs having competition. That's the real thing to grapple with.
See, it's funny. Each of these individual panels that we're truncating until about, like, everyone gets about four or five sentences could be their own panel, legitimately. But, you know, this is a podcast. We're trying to really condense it. The question that I think kind of plays across a sports fan level, and of course, lawyers. There will be lawyers involved in this conversation, I can guarantee you. When it comes to television contracts, they are drafted very clearly with respect to eyeballs being put on the sport. So in our last panel, which you guys didn't hear, but, you know, listeners will have heard this, we had a law student over from Scotland, and he had brought up a really interesting point. He said that the competition and the way that the Premier League, for example, there is an element to the Premier League which functions that, hey, you really want to fight to get into the Champions League. You want to fight to get into the Europa League. So maybe if you don't win, right, there's also the issue of relegation at the bottom of the table. So places 2 through 4 or 5 through 7, those have serious ramifications. And that's why these television deals are worth so much money, because every game, in theory, has some type of ramification. Now, as it's at least as the news, which I know is going to be different by the time most people listen to this podcast, but as of 3:47 on Monday, there was an emergency meeting for Serie A, which was Inter Milan, AC Milan, and Juventus, which they've stated their intention to remain in Serie A and also play in the Super League separately. And I think UEFA is going to say, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You got to pick one or the other. So, Tom, I'm going to turn this to you. We have television contracts, and as you know, Steve pointed out, agents are going to be looking at the player contracts. We're going to be looking very closely at these television contracts. If teams have to secede, right, as crazy as it sounds, if Liverpool pulls out of the Premier League and they pick the Super League, or they have to pick one or the other, I think there's going to be tremendous television ramifications, and let alone the fact that there's going to be a separate entity competing with the Champions League, competing with Europa League, competing with the Premier League. So I'm going to give it to you, Tom, and then everyone else can jump in. What are your thoughts on the ramifications of TV deals? So do we see mass anarchy? What do we have here? Breach of contract?
Well, it's actually interesting because you bring that up. Like, I mean, you look at some of the clubs here, they've already seen some of the impact on what teams are potentially going to be into the Super League. So PSG, Paris Saint-Germain, for example, their ownership includes a Qatari owner who actually is also the owner of beIN Sport, which is another major television rights venue and has several television rights for several different soccer events. So you can kind of see how they're looking at this going, well, I don't want to lessen my product that I'm, you know, as the owner of also this media company. You know, I think that it kind of comes down to, at least from what I was looking at in terms of how courts or how the courts are going to, if it gets to a legal perspective, how the courts are going to define the relevant market in terms of, you know, what's the impact, whether it significantly damages the television companies or the different deals that are happening. I think basically the toughest part is going to be the big deal is, like, for example, with the Premier League, that we not only talk about those top seven teams, but you have to talk about all 20 teams, because as the Premier League has their different marketing deals or network television deals, that money is spread out among the 20 teams that are in the Premier League. They're at different levels potentially, but they're spread out among those 20 teams. So you're not only talking about the competition between the Super League, for example, and the Premier League, but you're talking about, it's also going to directly impact the clubs themselves, including those lower level clubs, you know, that even if they're 15th or 16th in the table, it's going to make a big impact to them. So there really is a lot of trying to figure out how these contracts are worded is going to be the real key. If they specifically say club A, B, C, D, which I would imagine they don't, because obviously with promotion relegation, anything crazy can happen, evidenced by Leicester several years ago winning the title. I don't know if the TV companies necessarily are going to have that ability to stand and say, oh, well, these clubs aren't here, so it's not the Premier League. They're going to have to really make that argument more along the lines of, it has devalued the competition at the time that we purchased it. And that's going to have to be more of their main argument.
Or even, you know, because I was dealing with this on the COVID context when games were being canceled, right? All of a sudden you had a different product of game because there were players missing time. So maybe, and again, I mean, this is ideally, I think if you were one of these 16 or 12 Super League teams, I think their intention is to finish out the Champions League, finish out the Europa League, and then just have the separate entity that they have existing alone on the side. So the sports fan in me thinks, hey, I'm used to NFL Sundays. There are games every Sunday, and then maybe there's games on Mondays, game Thursday. There are no midweek games that are kind of slotted in here. So maybe the television partners, to your point, Tom, are like, hey, listen, we want the quality of game to be great. You know, we don't want you guys to be resting extra players because you have an additional league you put on your plate. I don't know. It's a fascinating topic. To Steve, to your point, and Katarina, I think this is a topic that just touches on so many areas. Before we move on to the next topic, does anybody have any other thoughts on the ramifications on TV deals?
Only thing I'd add is that there's this uncertainty about interim actions, you know, like expelling three of the clubs from the semifinals right now. I would imagine that the broadcasters, the media rights holders for the Champions League right now are concerned. You know, and it's a stakeholder that is a wild card, could come out, you know, trying to enjoin that action.
Well, the entire thing blew up actually over the fact that UEFA and ECA were setting up a joint venture that would manage the commercial rights to the newly reformed Champions League from 2024. And the entire thing blew up because they couldn't really agree on who will get to exploit those rights or over the exploitation of the commercial rights. So that was that, you know, what ignited this move, as I understand from some people from FIFA. the that would be pretty much in line. But I think the deal is ending on 2021, isn't it? So that it's a 3-year circle, that every 3 year there is a new tender for the TV rights. So I think they and they had to do this indeed, that they have timed it so when the deal expires that they leave.
I think this brings us to what I have as the last topic, and then I'm going to make sure everyone gets their own time just to kind of say what we're looking forward to, because these next couple of days are going to be, we'll say, if today's any indication, this week is going to be pretty wild on this front. So, Ted, you and I spoke offline. I think this is an interesting topic that people should be paying attention to. I know it because I'm seeing it all across Twitter and Instagram and any number of social media platforms. The public does not seem to be in support of this league. This is not... It's not something that, you know, maybe they thought the reaction to this league was going to be different and supporters of their team were going to be in favor. I mean, I'm seeing protests outside of Liverpool. I'm seeing hashtag stop, say no to the Super League. I don't know if they expected this, but I know they've hired a law firm to file trademarks. They filed Clifford, they're using Clifford Chance over, overseas. The groundwork has been laid for some period of time. I don't think this goes away so easily, but I don't know, Ted. Let me hand it to you. There's going to be a lot of these legal debates that are kind of, going to come down to public policy and public sentiment. So, Ted, I'm going to turn it over to you. I think it's just a fascinating topic.
Yeah, so do I. I think I saw that a hashtag boycott Super League was in front of just hashtag Super League. And the meme of the day appears to be created by the poor, stolen by the rich. It's interesting that as opposed to North American sports, where we really love our sports teams, but they are not, with very few exceptions, the true fabric of the community. That is the case with European soccer. And we're going to start to continue to hear that as a justification for arguing that the supporters groups should have a say in this. Perhaps even some of the players should have a say in this, because these communities are invested so heavily in the clubs. There was an American sports case some years ago where a pizzeria wanted to use the term Brooklyn Dodgers. And a court ruled that the term Brooklyn Dodgers was an immovable term, that it belonged to Brooklyn. I wonder whether or not we are going to see, as a legal argument, that Liverpool, for example, does not belong to John Henry and Fenway Sports Group, but it belongs to me, the lifelong Liverpool fan, and the rest of us who will never walk alone. It's going to be interesting to see whether or not that becomes a part of these legal arguments.
One thing I could add is it's notable that Germany does not have teams in here. Germany has a 50+1 rule, which requires majority ownership of the community. That is something you could see. One, that's a reason why you might not have Germany jumping. Two, you could see other leagues or nations adopting some kind of, trying to intervene to provide some kind of fan ownership. And I think Tom actually, it's got to have like a save the crew analogy here, because that's really what happened. You had, a lawmakers in Ohio after Cleveland Browns moved try to do something similar.
Yeah, if I could just jump in too, I think that this idea of the community is such a big deal in terms of, right, because the other difference, when you're thinking about in Europe, especially these bigger clubs compared to the U.S., in Europe, these teams have academy teams that start at U6, U5. So you've got 4, 5, 6-year-olds that are playing for, in the club, for Manchester United, for example, or Liverpool. And they grow up in that community. And I was looking actually, and there's an interesting, and this is just for England, but there's the Companies Act of 2006 that in the relevant section, I had to pull it out of here. It's section 172, says that a company director should have regard not just for owner profits, but the interests of stakeholders, including customers and the community. So in England, anyway, I don't know, obviously I was trying to see if there was something analogous in some of these other countries, but it seems like there may be potential legal justification or something that could be maybe leaned on that's in here that maybe members of parliament could partake in terms of this. But I think the community aspect is so important and really something, you know, these places, especially this past year, were food banks and were COVID vaccination spots for people in the community. I mean, you know, it's an entirely different, I think, understanding. I mean, there's some of it in North American sports, but this in Europe, it's such a much bigger level for sure.
We do know that the Secretary of State for Digital Culture, Media and Sport in the UK came out today and said that they're going to do everything in their power to stop this. We'll see whether or not they actually do.
That's right. I mean, the Super League has not consulted any stakeholders whatsoever. You know, the people and entities affected directly by this have not been consulted. And Europe, unlike the US, does have that, it's embedded in law, the societal, educational, cultural value. It's Article 165 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union that we are talking about. That is something that basically says, in essence, that all the enforcers of competition law, they are not to enforce the law as in any other industry, but to actually take into account the special characteristics of sports, which do include educational functions, social function, and the cultural aspects. And also, the article that I quoted was actually does refer to the openness of competition, which is also to be a consideration in enforcing the law. So it is not going to be a pure antitrust based on economic efficiencies as usual. It is going to be something of a bit different kind. If the European regulator decides to step in, or indeed any national competition regulator, because they have the power to enforce European laws as well.
Guys, this was fantastic. I will say, you know, we have in our remaining minutes left, I want to give everyone just the floor to kind of say, I don't necessarily say their piece, but kind of give us some guidance as to what to look for ahead and kind of the big tenets coming out of the show. Ted, I started with the intros with you. Let's start with you on this round. So give us your thoughts, what to look forward to this week, and maybe some big picture items we should be looking for.
This week, wow, who knows? We are going to enter into a time here this week where nothing is going to be the same. What do I think is going to happen? You know, I always tell my students, don't look at tomorrow as much as you look at 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. I think that they're going to go through with this because money always talks. And I think that in the end, the football pyramid as we know it in the UK and the entire soccer structure in Europe will completely change. And we all better get ready for it.
There are two sides to the pyramid. There is a regulatory pyramid and there is a commercial pyramid. And the regulatory pyramid, that is the monopoly, and that is supposed to stay in the hands of governing body as per, you know, also the ISU case. As far as commercial monopoly, that's the different beast. But then the clubs were supposed to approach UEFA under Article 49 of the UEFA statutes and ask them for, you know, approval. So as to, and then they would be legally in much better position because they would throw the ball over to UEFA and then UEFA would have to come up with the conditions for access that are non-discriminatory, transparent, and proportionate.
Steve, let me turn it to you, and then Tom, you can send us home.
So, if you're asking this week, I mean, it's hard to tell, but one could imagine some kind of swift action is what the populace is calling for. It's essentially calling for people's heads, and so removing those countries from the Champions League, and that will be kind of the point of no return, I think, because once they're gone, you can't really settle it easily. You know, once that you've excluded them, but longer term, I guess I would just caution reading too much into what Katarina correctly pointed out. 165(1) of the, you know, the EU treaty is pretty clear that this is special status of sport and all that. But there have been a long string of cases starting Mecca Medina and but the, you know, International Skating Union that make clear that there's, you know, that doesn't mean you're free from sort of a conditional autonomy. You have to be subject to the EU basic principles. And one of those principles that I keep going back to in the International Skating Union case, where they, you know, straight out said, third-party organizers have to have access to the relevant market. And so I'm not sure how they're balancing those two things, but they're pretty clear about that in the International Skating Union. So I just think that this case is not as easy either way as people give it credit for. But if UEFA needs to tread carefully, because if they really do kick them out now, I'm not sure there's any point of any return. I think we're done. We're going down the litigation front, the bull bear.
Okay, and Tom, I feel like there can't be bigger picture items than this. We got a lot to chew on this. But Tom, send us home. What else are we looking forward to?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a lot of great points. I mean, you're talking about, in a lot of these cases, depending on how you look at it, you're talking about one monopoly complaining against another monopoly in a sense of, the Premier League, which is a team that is obviously does have the promotion relegation, is 20 teams, is saying that this other 12 team, league on the one sense is taking their money away from them. And that's where this is so interesting because of the EU, the different legal framework that's going to be here to figure out, what's going to allow the marketplace, in terms of how that's going to be determined, whether the markets are, are being protected, so to speak, by the inclusion or the uninclusion of the Super League here. So it's really going to be an interesting thing in the short term to see if any of this quick action does happen. And, it kind of, one of the things that I thought of, even though they're kind of related, but not entirely, is the how this might compare to the potential here in the US, the potential MLS, Liga MX merger. And in Europe, there's also the Belgian Dutch clubs forming a potential league together, though those obviously have slightly different reasons. So it'll be interesting to see, how the Super League and what comes of that is impacting on any kind of future potential, either super leagues, quote unquote, or mergers between two leagues.
With all due respect, gentlemen, Kat officially wrote the book on this, which I'm just shocked. EU sports law and breakaway leagues in football. Kat, when did you write this? 2012?
It was in 2015 that I finished it. I've been writing it for several years. That was my PhD.
That was turned into a book.
Yeah,
I would say a pretty good topic for your PhD. I feel like most of us don't get to use our thesis. Mine is still sitting somewhere collecting dust, but yours actually is probably the most relevant piece of literature that's out on this topic. So definitely, we will drop a copy of the book in the show notes, and we'll put it on Twitter and elsewhere.
Oh, thanks.
But guys, thank you so much for joining us. This will conclude panel two. We come up with the good names here. That's why they pay us the big bucks, the Super League Symposium. Guys, thank you so much. And this will be dropping at some point tonight. Thank you very much. Whoa, a double episode of Conduct Detrimental. Taryn suggested that we make this one mega episode, and I'm happy that we did. Taryn, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. That was a riveting discussion, and credit to you, Dan, putting this together on very, very quick turnaround. And I'm glad that we were able to hear from really the authorities on this matter.
Yeah, we lost Stephanie along the way. Duty calls, with class and other responsibilities. But yeah, I wanted to take today, if anyone's paying attention to social, just to have a spotlight on this issue. I think it is a massive, massive issue. Bigger than anything that can come with the Deshaun Watson case, bigger than anything, obviously, with Aaron Donald. We were having fun in the intro, but like, this is a case that affects countries and billions, God forbid, maybe trillions. There are so many leagues that are touched upon by this. And these television deals are in the, in the 9-10 figure range. This is big. So, I will say as we're closing, this is called the Super League. And if you listen to everyone's comments, if you watch social media, right, boycott Super League is trending. Ted said that. Say no to the Super League is trending. This is really, Super League didn't expect this, but this is really lacking in public support. I know Ted and Steve were joking offline that this is not the Super League because it only really impacts three countries. Maybe this is the medium league, but it's facing its adders on a number of levels. And the entity that we have not heard weigh in here, and obviously the panel, when we hit stop, there was a conversation that occurred. Hey, if you're really going to threaten to take players away from the World Cup, FIFA has to have some position here. So we've heard from UEFA, we've heard from the Premier League, we've heard from Boris Johnson, we've heard from a lot of politicians, but we haven't heard from FIFA. FIFA is the shoe to drop. And unless FIFA is really backing all of these UEFA bans, these might just be bluffs. So I don't know. Taryn, what are your thoughts on this overall madness?
It's just a very interesting time to be following the sport, and it remains to be seen how this will shake out. But I have to think that they believed that this was coming. They hired a public relations firm that has experience with English politics. So we'll see if they're able to come out on the other side of this.
That said, thank you for joining us. We will obviously stay on top of this. This is a story that's not going away anytime soon. I am Dan Lust. I'm at Sports Law Lust for Dan Wallach. He is at Wallach Legal. Taryn is at TK Sharma Law. And Stephanie is at S Weisenberger _. That'll put this episode of Conduct Detrimental in the books. As always, stay tuned to our social feeds for the latest breaking at the intersection of sports and law. And we will see you next week on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.